Hey everyone, Kevin Rose here. Long time no podcast. It has been a while since I've published an episode of The Kevin Rose Show. Welcome back. If you're wondering where I've been, I have two new podcasts that I'm focusing my attention on. One called Modern Finance that covers all things cryptocurrency and finance. And the other is called Proof. Proof covers the entire NFT landscape. That means we interview artists, builders, industry experts to help you understand that crazy, fast-moving part of cryptocurrency. I had to break it apart because NFTs are just so kind of blowing up right now. I wanted to give it its own dedicated show. These two podcasts that I now produce can be found at modern.finance, that's the URL, and also proof.xyz, proof.xyz. If you go there, you'll see all the links to subscribe on your favorite platforms. So because I have been so busy on those shows, I've been more or less neglecting the Kevin Rose Show because frankly, it's just impossible to do everything. That said, every once in a while, a guest comes along that I just must interview for the show. And that's why I'm still keeping the show going. It's less frequent, but there will be fantastic guests when we do publish a new episode. Now, way back on episode 23 of The Kevin Rose Show, which was actually released on April 29th of 2018, I had on Matt Walker to talk about sleep, why it's vital, and how if we don't get enough of it, it can certainly be hazardous to our health. That episode just went completely viral on my feed. I think there was only one other episode that topped it, but it was 4 to 5x, probably more, my normal downloads. That means that a lot of people were sharing it around. Very, very popular interview. So now it's been, 3 years later, and of course the science has evolved. So I wanted to have Matt back on the show to give us the latest update. And as a reminder, Matthew Walker is a professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley. He's the director of its sleep and neuroimaging lab and a former professor of psychiatry at Harvard University. He has published over 100 scientific studies and has appeared on 60 Minutes, Nova, BBC News, and NPR's Science Friday. And he also wrote a fantastic book. That's what we covered in the first episode that I recorded with him a few years ago called Why We Sleep. So have a listen to this Amazon review. And this is a quote, "Why We Sleep is an important and fascinating book. Walker taught me a lot about the basic activity that every person on earth needs. I suspect this book will do the same for you." That reviewer was Bill Gates, so he certainly has some pretty influential fans. So we cover a lot in this episode, like THC and CBD for sleep, other popular sleep compounds, including some prescription meds as well, the effects of alcohol and caffeine and how his thinking around coffee has changed, and also these new smart mattresses and a whole lot more. This, I would say, was a fantastic show. I know you're going to enjoy it. This is Matt Walker. Matt, so stoked that you're coming back on the show. Thank you for joining me again.
Oh, it is an absolute pleasure and a delight. It's always lovely to chat with you, Kevin.
Yeah, it's. I wish we weren't in COVID times and we could be hanging in person and, grab a beer on the early side because I know you will only drink if it's noon.
Yeah, noon or before.
And which means you're an alcoholic or a really smart scientist. And I think it's the latter.
I promise we can explain that to the audience at some point. I know it sounds desperately, odd as a scientist to say that and a medical professional, but I can explain it. So at some point we will do this in person and we will be able to give each other both a hug at the start and the end of it too. So yeah. I look forward to that day.
That sounds great. You don't know this, but your podcast, I think, was the number two most listened to show I've ever had. And it was spread just so far and wide. Outside of my own audience, you notice that because you have your normal baseline numbers for what a successful show looks like. And then there's just a huge spike. And that means it went viral. That means people cared so much about the topic of sleep, how it applies to longevity and dementia and all the things that, we covered. And there's been enough time now where I guess it's been, like a couple years now. Yeah. I would love to dive in and get the update, because I know this science is obviously rapidly evolving and changing over time, and you're right in the mix of it. But before we do that, let's talk about your podcast, because I think this is the most important piece of news, because you and I can do this every couple of years, but you actually have a show out now where you're giving more regular updates. Tell me about that show.
Yeah, so the podcast, it was desperately unoriginal in terms of its name. It's called The Matt Walker Podcast. And the aim of the podcast is really to democratize the science of sleep throughout society. And it's not hidden behind any paywalls for folks. And the podcast is probably a little different than most. Rather than it being a long-form podcast lasting several hours with interviews, which I love, by the way, instead, the episodes for my podcast are short-form monologues from yours truly, lasting somewhere between about 5 to 10 minutes in length. So you can think of them, I suppose, as a little slice of sleep goodness to accompany your waking day. And I should note, by the way, the overall motivation and goal of the podcast was really pretty simple. I just wanted to try and reunite humanity with the sleep that it is so desperately bereft of. And so far, the audience has been desperately kind and wonderfully supportive. I am very new in this podcast space in the sense of doing it myself. I've got so much to learn. Personality transplant included. So it's been a good fun ride so far.
Yeah. And it's cool that you now have a channel to just drop the latest and greatest, right? Like knowledge as it's like, you know, well, it's, I guess it's not hitting the press anymore because who knows how far it actually gets syndicated when you come out with something new. But if you have a new line of thinking or a new device that you're excited about or a supplement that either does or does not work, like you can just put that information out there. Is that kind of the idea, is more timely updates?
I think it's going to be a combination of both. What I want to do to begin with is set the foundational elements of sleep science so that everyone is on the same page in terms of what this thing called sleep is and how it works. And then once we've established that, the podcast will go all over the map. So we will talk about sleep and relationships, sleep and sex. We'll speak about sleep and diet, sleep and exercise, sleep and mental health. There'll be a whole series, of course, on sleep and dreaming and lucid dreaming. We'll speak about sleep and supplementation, sleep and diseases, things such as Alzheimer's disease, cancer, diabetes. And then it will be constantly evolving with all of the latest and greatest, as you said, in sleep science. What am I changing my mind on? There will be episodes and, in fact, entire series on sleep myths that hopefully we can bust and give people the authentic facts. There will be plenty of tips and tricks in terms of optimizing your sleep. So it will be a whole kaleidoscope of different topics that is this thing called sleep and dreaming.
That is awesome. Well, I am a subscriber, and if for people that want to subscribe, obviously they can go to their favorite podcast platform and just type in Matt Walker Show. Do you have a website that has links to all those platforms as well?
I do indeed. Yep. So if you just Google Matt Walker Podcast, you will definitely find it.
Fantastic. Cool. Well, let's get into chatting about sleep and the updates on across a whole slew of different things. I heard that, I think my wife was telling me that she heard your interview recently. Did you do the Huberman Show?
Yeah, with Andrew.
Okay,
yeah.
That's what it was. Yeah, she said that, oh, he's kind of changed his mind a little bit on caffeine. And I was like, what? That doesn't sound like Matt. Like, yeah. Let's talk about caffeine for a second. I'm drinking some green tea right now, and it's 1 o'clock. So I'm not doing the best. But tell me what's changed there for you?
Yeah, I think I was probably a little bit puritanical about the whole topic of sleep when the book first came out several years ago, just because I was so passionate about sleep. And sleep at that time was almost the neglected stepsister in the health conversation of that time. You know, we spoke a lot about diet and exercise, and sleep wasn't really on the map as much as I felt it should be. And so I probably came out the gate a bit too strong. Coffee is really interesting, and I have changed my tune on that based on the evidence since the book came out. And my advice now is, ironically, drink coffee. And I'll explain why I have that mindset. But I'll also say that the timing and the dose make the poison when it comes to coffee. Firstly, coffee is associated with a remarkable set of health benefits. It seems to be associated with a de-risking of numerous different forms of diseases and disorders. And the strange paradox that people would then come to me with was the following. Many of the things that a cup of coffee has been associated with in terms of health benefits are also the same things that sleep seems to be great at helping you out with in terms of your health and your disease risk. But so Alzheimer's disease, cancer, diabetes, hypertension, stroke, depression, there was such a Venn diagram overlap between the benefits of a cup of coffee and the benefits of sleep. And people were saying, but how do you reconcile that, Matt, that caffeine obviously has a deleterious impact on sleep? How can these two things seem to go hand in hand? And the very simple answer, it turns out, is antioxidants. That the coffee bean, the humble coffee bean, is packed full of antioxidants. And based on the standard American diet, which is obviously not ideal, the way that most people actually get the daily dose of antioxidants is through a cup of coffee. And it's not the caffeine that has the health benefits, because if you take decaffeinated coffee, which still has the antioxidant benefits, but is obviously de-escalated in terms of its amount of caffeine, it too has many health benefits. So it's the coffee bean itself and the antioxidant dose in the coffee bean rather than the caffeine. And that's why I think a cup of coffee is a great thing, because it's a vehicle through which many people get that critical antioxidant dose. But I guess that does bring us on to the issue of timing and dose, which I'm more than happy to go into. But any thoughts or questions here?
Yeah, I'm curious. So it doesn't sound like the science has changed in terms of it impacting your sleep in a negative way. There just also happens to be positive benefits for taking it. So it's like, it's kind of like, is that true where you're saying, okay, there's a lot of great benefits here. Guess what? If you wake up at 7 a.m., that coffee should hit your lips at 7:01 versus 2 p.m.?
That's exactly right. So you can go all the way up to 3 cups of coffee and you still see some of these health association benefits. I would say though that this is where the dose comes into. Once you get past that, then there is a negative direction in terms of health associations. So there is, it's almost a Goldilocks syndrome, not too little, not too much, just the right amount in terms of the dose. But then the timing is also critical. And this is your astute point, which is, if I'm waking up, when should I be drinking coffee? The science on that has not changed regarding its impact on sleep. What we know is that for the average adult, the half-life of caffeine is somewhere between about 5 to 6 hours, which means that caffeine has a quarter life of somewhere between 10 to 12 hours.
Yeah, it's funny how people don't quite understand. They think, oh, half-life just means the other half will be out in that much time again. And you're like, no, it just means it halves again, right? Like,
exactly. So the half-life essentially is that after 5 to 6 hours following a cup of coffee, 50% of that caffeine is still in your system, which means that after 10 to 12 hours, a quarter of that caffeine is still in your system. So having a cup of coffee at noon, you could argue, is the equivalent of just before you get into bed at midnight, you swig a quarter of a cup of coffee and you hope for a good night of sleep. And the chances are it's probably not going to happen. So I would say try to cut the caffeine use off somewhere between certainly 10 to 12 hours before you expect to go to bed. There is, however, a considerable, and actually let me back up, the way that caffeine can impact your sleep is in 3 different ways. Firstly, obviously, caffeine is a stimulant. It's in a class of drugs that we call the psychoactive stimulants, and it just makes it more difficult for you to fall asleep. The second component of caffeine is that it will increase the frequency with which you wake up throughout the night and therefore make it harder to fall back asleep when you've woken up. The third point brings me back to the half-life, because some people will tell me, look, I'm one of those individuals. I can have an espresso with dinner and I fall asleep fine and I stay asleep. So caffeine doesn't really impact my sleep. The only downside to that is that we also know caffeine can decrease the depth of your deep sleep.
Ah, you're killing me here because that's what I see on the Oura Ring. I'm poor at the deep sleep. So,
and that's where caffeine, and that's the sort of the hidden backdoor impact that caffeine can have in terms of a blast radius that you are unaware of, which is you say, well, I don't remember having a hard time falling asleep and I don't remember waking up throughout the night. But when I wake up the next morning, I don't feel restored by my sleep. I don't feel particularly refreshed. Yeah, I'm so sorry.
Matt, why are we doing this podcast, dude? You're killing me here.
I'm so sorry. At least I'm giving some, you know, there is permission there to keep drinking the coffee, maybe just trying to be mindful of the timing. And by the way, we know exactly why those people have a difference in their sensitivity. There is a specific gene that will determine an enzyme. It's called a cytochrome P450 enzyme, which exists in your liver, and it helps with the clearance of caffeine. And if you want to get really nerdy, the gene is called CYP1A2. And if you do, you know, Ancestry or 23andMe, those types of tests, you can actually figure out which type of version of this gene you have. And therefore, that gene means, are you a slow metabolizer or a fast metabolizer?
Is there anything you can do to create, like somehow express, turn on that gene or any enzymes I can take to help with the clearance of caffeine?
Not that we found yet. And, you know, you can, the other way people start to push back against that is, unfortunately, they'll drink too much caffeine during the day. They're wired, but they're tired at night. And then they'll either start to use alcohol or prescription sleep aids. And so you've got this kind of this upper and downer drug dependency where you're taking sleeping medications or alcohol at night to help you get to sleep. Then you feel pretty miserable the next morning. So you're drinking more coffee throughout the day, which means then you need more of the downers in the evening to get you to sleep and more of the uppers, the stimulants in the morning. And that's the way most people try to deal with the excess caffeine. But we don't currently have any known methods to dial up the volume on the activity of that gene.
How about tea versus coffee?
It really depends on the type of tea. And there is, you can go onto the internet and there's some great resources that will give you essentially the full back catalog of caffeine content for both different flavors and forms of coffee, as well as different versions of tea. Some versions of black tea can get, you know, 60 to 70%, you know, close to the amount of caffeine in drip brewed coffee. Other teas, very light on the tiller of caffeine concentration. So you can explore around and see exactly what it is. And by the way, if you're wanting to do the experiment with caffeine, I always tell people when it comes to sleep, no matter what you're trying to do, be it supplements or caffeine, make sure that you do the negative, positive, negative experiment. And what I mean by that is start off by, let's say, not having taken that supplement and get a baseline of your sleep, then go on the supplement and see if anything changes about your sleep. But then make sure that you do the final third part of the play act, which is then come back off the supplement and see if your sleep gets worse as a consequence. And that way you can determine, is it just a placebo effect where I started this thing, which is the second part of the three-part experiment, and you think, wow, great, my sleep has improved. Prove to me that that's the case by coming back off that intervention and showing me that the sleep gets worse as a consequence. That to me is a much more powerful way to explore your sleep in relationship to things like caffeine and different types of supplements. Does that make any sense, Kevin?
It does. Yeah. Two questions here that I think are important to unpack. One, for someone that does not have a lab, you know, what can they use that is not subjective to gauge their sleep. I know we've talked about Oura before. We've talked about all these different types of Apple now does some basic rudimentary kind of sleep detection with the Apple Watch. Like, I know none of these devices are perfect, right?
Yeah.
So what would you recommend people use for that baseline? And then also, or not for the baseline, but for the experiments, but then also how long do they try a supplement? Is it a week long experiment and then go off for a week? Or what's your thoughts there?
Great question. So when it comes to sleep trackers, when people say, you know, what do you think is the best sleep tracker? My typical answer is the one that you wear most. Because I think often what we forget in the domain of sleep technology is compliance and adherence. And what gets measured gets managed. And if you're not recording that data, then the sleep device, this is why I'm not a big fan of sort of all of the headband technology or...
Oh yeah, man, I've tried those. Those things fall off in the middle of the night and they just like turn sideways. And it's a great idea on paper, but they're just so cumbersome, you know?
And I've tried just about every sleep device that there is out there. I'm very enamored with this idea of unwearables when it comes to sleep. And the reason that I ended up using Oura, the Oura Ring, as my go-to sleep tracking device was really because of the form factor. You know, we typically take things off when we go to bed. We don't put things on. But many of us will go to sleep with a ring on, and that doesn't feel as intrusive or obtrusive. And so that's why I like the form factor. As you also mentioned, many of the sleep trackers out there are much of a muchness in terms of their accuracy, be it a ring, be it a wristwatch, etc. And full disclosure, since I was wearing the Oura Ring for about 2.5 years, and then I decided that I would come on board with the company, and I'm a scientific officer and advisor there for them. Mm. So take whatever I say about the Oura Ring with a complete grain of salt, but I was using it and had used all of the different devices before for several years, and it did stick with me. I would say right now that most of the trackers are somewhere between 70 to 75% accurate relative to the gold standard sleep laboratory recordings that I do at my sleep center.
What do you think, which stage of sleep is hardest to pin down with a tracker? Like for me, and I just don't know if it's the tracker's actually being really accurate, but I've kind of been all over the map when I look at my Oura data and I see my deep sleep, and I just like, it seems to like the REM stuff, it's actually a lot easier to kind of gauge. I'm like, yeah, I do remember having really vivid dreams during these hours. And you know, you look down and like, you can make that association. Is deep the hardest to get accurate?
It is. It's one of the hardest out of the four states. So sleep trackers will typically differentiate you being awake, you being in light non-REM sleep, being in deep non-REM sleep, or being in REM sleep. So those are the four states that most of them try to disambiguate. Deep sleep has been quite difficult to get high levels of accuracy on. What I would say, however, is that many of them fail not on the three sleep states of light non-REM, deep non-REM, or REM, but mostly on wake during the night. Mm. And wakefulness at night, I think, is being a harder thing to disambiguate, which sounds strange, but if you try to understand some of the physiology, it does make a little bit more sense. You're right, however, that REM sleep is typically an easier state to identify. And part of the reason that many people probably don't understand is that when you go into REM sleep, which is the principal state within which you dream, your brain paralyzes your body. So you are locked into a physical incarceration every time.
Accelerometer basically there is precisely a huge piece of the data. Yeah,
exactly. And there it's not as though you get small sort of, you know, tremors or a little bit of background movement. You are literally in what we call muscle atonia. All of your voluntary skeletal muscles become paralyzed because there's a part of your brainstem that sends a signal down your spinal cord, and it inactivates what we call the alpha motor neurons in your spinal cord, which are the things that control your voluntary skeletal muscles. Thankfully, the involuntary muscles don't undergo the paralysis. Otherwise, we'd be popped out the gene pool very quickly.
So why doesn't that apply to dogs? Because I see my dog, Mr. Toast, he lays on his side. He's chasing all kinds of squirrels and shit, with kicking his legs and growling and stuff when he's sleeping.
Yeah. So how old is he?
He's 10.
So the reason that you're starting to see this now in a way that you probably didn't see it when he was younger is that as we get older in life, the part of the brainstem that sends that inhibitory signal to say, shut the body down. And of course, the reason from an evolutionary perspective is hopefully obvious, that the brain paralyzes the body so the mind can dream safely, so that we don't act out your dream. Mm. But the reason that, sorry, what was your dog's name again?
Toaster.
Oh, I love it. And I imagine, I'm hoping that that's the technology component of the naming. But so the reason that Toaster is starting to express his dreams, and the reason that we often will do that as we get into the later stages of life, is because that part of the brain starts to deteriorate and we don't send the signal down the brainstem as effectively down into the spinal cord. And that's why a disorder called REM sleep behavioral disorder, or RBD, starts to be expressed once you get past the age of about 50 years old. It's much more common in males than it is in females. And at that point, you will start to act out your dreams. And it can be actually quite aversive, quite dangerous to both the person who's experiencing this and, of course, their bed partner, should they share a bed with a partner. But that's the reason that Toaster is starting to express those movements during REM sleep, is because that paralysis is becoming weaker and weaker the older and older Toaster becomes.
Oh, that's so sad. It's just, as a bad news podcast, Matt. Like, this Toaster's getting old.
In another way, it's fascinating because it's probably the best evidence that we have that animals also dream. You know, it's very, we know for a fact that animals have REM sleep, from which dreams come. But unfortunately, we can't ask dogs,
how was your dream last night?
But exactly. But their behavior through this absence of the paralysis has been some of the best evidence yet that we are not the only species who dreams, that there must be other species, because it seems to be pretty clear that's what's happening to Toaster.
Yeah, it makes sense. A question about these different stages and how people try and address them. And, you know, a lot of my friends, the biohacker crew, and actually more consumer friends these days, they do have like the Oura rings or some other sleep tracker. They're wearing them. And the number one thing people tell me in this day and age is that they just take a weed gummy. They're just like, okay, I got my little, they're everywhere now. They're legal and in most states, and you can just walk down by them. There's they're standardized. Thank God they're standardized now, because the Wild West was never fun with those things. I remember the Wild West days, man. And it was pretty hardcore.
You had no idea what your night was going to bring.
Oh, no idea. And it was Russia roulette. And it's like, never knew. But, you know, a lot of friends and people I know, they grab a 2.5 milligram, you know, some form of hybrid THC, CBD, CBN. Now is the new hotness. There's like a CBX, you know, whatever X may be next week, that they tend to be exploring. And for them, they're like, that works for me. And they feel better than when they were not taking that because, you know, they had some type of sleep issue. You're anti-THC, though. Is that still correct?
I'm probably getting more bullish on CBD, but I've consistently been bearish and remain bearish on THC. And the problem with THC, it can help people fall asleep faster. But the problem with THC is that, well, there are two problems, really. The first is that it's pretty good at blocking your REM sleep, blocking your dream sleep. And we know that REM sleep is essential for aspects of your emotional and mental health. It's critical for memory and creativity. It's also essential for the regulation of your hormones. For example, REM sleep is the time when males will actually release their peak levels of testosterone. So it's critical for that aspect of wellness and virility in males. And of course, testosterone is also critical in females too. So that's the first issue with THC.
Does that vary from person to person, though? Because, you know, for me, if I take a gummy before I go to bed, a 2.5, you know, I get creative as all hell when I'm on like awake and all this. Like I'm like drawing things and thinking of new product ideas and like all over the place. And then when I'm sleeping, I'll just be like, you know, dreaming about the craziest stuff.
Right.
You know, and I don't do it. That's why I don't do it, because it actually just completely destroys my deep sleep, what little I had to begin with. But I get tons of REM. Am I just a weird person? Is that not the norm? Or is that not true REM sleep? Is that just something else?
It's possible that the device is not accurately staging REM sleep as REM sleep because your heart rate and your physiology. So it's not just the lack of motion that these devices use. When you go into paralysis, as we said before, that's the reason that you can track REM sleep with a little bit more accuracy, because it's so obvious due to the paralysis, and the accelerometer thinks, oh, okay, I've got this. I know what this is. It's called REM sleep because there's no movement whatsoever. But when you have a drug like THC in the system, the other aspects that it also uses to determine REM sleep from deep sleep, things such as your heart rate variability, your respiration rate, those things are altered as a consequence of THC, and therefore the accuracy of the device under the duress of THC can be significantly worse, and therefore the trust in that number can be worse. But it's usually REM sleep where we see the impact. What you may be experiencing, however, is what we call a REM sleep rebound effect. And this happens with alcohol too. So let's say that you, not you, of course, because you have utter puritanical practices around sleep, I'm sure. You have had
mine are pretty good. Mine are horrible, but they're not the best.
Okay. I will come into
my big offender is wine, which we'll get into. But
well, this is what I'm about to mention. So let's say that you have, you know, a little bit too much to drink one evening, and alcohol also will block your REM sleep through a different mechanism. But the brain is very smart, and it keeps a clock counter of how much REM sleep throughout the night that you should have been having, but have not been able to have because of either THC or alcohol being in the system. And then finally, when your liver and your kidneys have processed and cleared either the THC or the alcohol from the system, not only does your brain go back then to continuing to have the REM sleep it would have had normally, it gets that. Plus, it tries to get back some of the REM sleep that it's lost throughout the night. And this is what we call a REM sleep rebound effect. The problem is that it's never able to get back all the REM sleep that it's lost. But what will happen is that in those last couple of morning hours, you will typically have more intense REM sleep than you would otherwise. And that's why people will say, geez, you know, I had a few too many drinks last night, and this morning I was having these really intense, crazy dreams. It's the REM sleep rebound effect. And that's why you may be having those really intense sort of pseudo creative dreams.
Gotcha. Wow. Crazy. And then on the CBD side, is just the data not supported as being beneficial?
Yeah. And I should note, by the way, for the THC, the other downside there is that you quickly develop dependency. And so yes, THC can help you initially start to fall asleep a little bit faster, but then very quickly you have to start taking that plus potentially more to get the same benefit. So you develop tolerance. And then when you stop, you have this really horrific, typically cannabis withdrawal insomnia syndrome. And it's listed as part of the cannabis withdrawal complement of negative consequences, which is this pretty vicious insomnia. And the downside there is that the individual then inadvertently thinks, well, when I stopped using cannabis, my sleep gets worse. So the cannabis is actually helping my sleep. It wasn't. They're just unwittingly caught up in a negative dependency spiral. And therefore, you kind of have to go cold turkey for some time to get back to your normative sleep, which is probably just fine once you address the thing that was preventing it, which is often anxiety. Hmm. So that's THC. And I'm sorry, God, I'm I mean, I often say I'm a desperately unpopular person based on personality and nationality, but these things, these conversations make me even more unpopular because I seem to be like sort of Eeyore out of Winnie the Pooh, you know, everything, oh, everything is bad news. But let's come on to a slightly better news, which is CBD. I am actually a little bit more bullish now. I don't think there's anywhere near the evidence for any sleep specialist like myself to come out and say, we definitely think that CBD is beneficial for sleep. But right now, I think the strongest thing we can say is that CBD doesn't seem to hurt your sleep in the same way that THC does. If anything, looking at the data so far, and we need more of it, but looking at the data in both animal studies and in human studies, there does seem to be a potential sleep benefit, and potential in two ways. Firstly, lack of evidence. Second, here again, the dose is critical. And most people don't realize this with CBD, and it hasn't been really discussed. In lower doses, CBD, there is some evidence that it can actually be wake promoting. And so if you're taking too low a dose, it will actually keep you awake at night. Once you get to higher doses, that's when we see this soporific effect, and it can induce what we call somnolence. In other words, it helps you with your sleep.
So out here in Portland, Oregon, we have, you know, it's sold in the grocery stores, all this stuff is, and you know, you go and walk up and there's a whole slew of different doses for CBD. And what kind of milligram range are we talking about in the studies for when you pass that threshold where it potentially could be beneficial?
It seems to be somewhere based on the evidence right now, sort of north of 30 to 40 milligrams. So it's typically a higher dose than you would see otherwise. Once you get below about 20 milligrams, things may take a turn in the wake promoting opposite direction, which is not going to necessarily favor sleep.
And it's also, I'm sure the manufacturer matters as well, because as we know with unregulated supplementation, it seems to me that there just could be so much variance in dose. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that applies to this world as well. Do you believe that to be the case?
I very much believe that to be the case. And I would highly recommend doing your diligence on if you're going to do this, on who your provider is. And of course, I'm not a medical doctor, and none of the things that I say are prescriptive in any way or reflect medical advice, but certainly you would want to look at the vendor, look at the brand, and make sure that they offer third-party independent laboratory testing that you can then go to. I think many of them now have QRI codes. I don't know if they can hack this system or not, and it's just smoke and mirrors, but there are companies who are trying to do third-party validation of their purity, and that could at least be one way that you could bootstrap and safety gap that potential concern.
Without mentioning specific vendors, are there third-party validators that you trust? Like you would look and say, because like anyone can say, hey, we've been validated by this lab, and then right. It could be a crappy lab.
Not that I'm aware of right now. That's probably not an area that I have done enough research in. I know of a couple of companies who are really trying to do this with high degrees of integrity. Will they become the industry standard? I don't know. I certainly think that we need at least 2 to 3 industry standard players that are the trusted source of validation.
When you test CBD in your lab and you actually, have you published science on CBD yet?
Not yet. Although I've had a lot of companies come to me thinking about this. And in fact, Berkeley, of course, being Berkeley, we have a cannabis center here on the campus, which I started to explore working with. But there's actually a company based out of Europe and the UK that I'm probably now going to start working with, because I was reticent to do this before. It felt a little bit like charlatan science, and perhaps the field, my academic field in particular, wouldn't be receptive of someone like me trying to do studies like this. But the genie of CBD and THC is out the bottle, and it's not going back in anytime soon.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then I actually think it is the responsibility of scientists like myself to come into the field and see if we can offer really good, authentic, standardized, genuine science to explore this. Because if this ends up being a useful sleep aid, and considering what we know about the deleterious effects of current sleeping prescription medication that you get from your doctor, I think that would be a service to humanity, I hope, to try to discover. And the reason I became a little bit more enamored with CBD is because the mechanisms are starting to become clear in my mind. Firstly, I think there is very good scientific evidence that CBD acts as what we call an anxiolytic. In other words, it reduces your stress, it reduces your anxiety. And there's some even fascinating brain imaging studies recently where they were giving people CBD, and I cannot remember for the life of me what the dose was in this study. And they were looking at the deep emotional centers of the brain, centers that are typically hyperactive or overactive in people with high levels of anxiety. And sure enough, when you dose them with CBD, those deep emotional brain centers stopped being so erratic and hyperreactive, as if CBD was quelling the emotional centers. And you can look at this in other measures too. You can look at it in terms of cortisol reaction in the body. So I think the anxiolytic benefit is clear. And why does that make me become excited about sleep? One of the principal roadblocks to this thing called a good night of sleep is anxiety. And in fact, biological stress and anxiety is one of our leading theories underlying the condition of insomnia. There are many causes of insomnia, but a hyperactive stress system seems to be one of the common single pathways through which we typically can explain insomnia. And therefore, anything that comes in to de-escalate the situation of anxiety in an individual is going to have an indirect benefit in gifting that individual with better sleep at night.
Yeah. It's probably going to be the most elegant and cleanest way, rather than hitting someone with a sledgehammer of something that's like, you know, crossing the blood-brain barrier and doing something that's like really detrimental to the actual brain itself. Would that be, well, I guess CBD would cross into the brain as well. Is that correct?
I do think it does have an effect, but I think what's nice about its effect is that, and I'll come onto the second pathway that I'm sort of quite bullish about, which I'm sure probably means this is some my own hand-waving theory from a little bit of evidence, which means that it's definitely going to be wrong. But I think the sleeping pills right now that we have, although there is a time and place for those sleeping pills, unfortunately, they are pretty blunt instruments and they don't typically produce naturalistic sleep. What they do is simply sedate your cortex. Right. They just knock your cortex out. And sedation isn't sleep. But when you're taking those medications, you mistake the former for the latter.
Yeah, what happens, there must be some, I'm curious for the people that do get, like they wake up refreshed or more so than they normally would be after taking some type of sleep med. Is it just that is like helping them to fall asleep and eventually it wears off and the bulk of the beneficial piece, like there's going to be some benefit there, right? Otherwise they wouldn't wake up feeling refreshed. Is that just happening at the tail end once the medication is wearing off? Like why would they get some of the refreshment if there was no benefit at all?
Typically we don't see that refreshment. If anything, people will often complain of what we call unrestorative sleep. And in part, that's perhaps due to the half-life of that drug, where you have a hangover effect and you just feel a little bit groggy in the morning. So I think it's unclear really how truly restorative the sleep is with those medications. And again, I'm not a doctor, and I also think there is a time and a place. But right now, as a medical field, in 2016, the American College of Physicians evaluated many different studies of sleeping pills, and they made a landmark recommendation. They said, based on the weight of the evidence, sleeping pills must not be the first line recommended treatment for insomnia. It must be cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI, which is a psychological intervention where you work with a therapist. So I think there is a movement in the medical field away from sleeping medications. And I think that that's in part why we've seen this exponential increase in the use of both THC and CBD for sleep aids, because people right. feel naturally when I'm using those sleeping pills, I don't really enjoy the sleep that it gives me, and I'd like to look for something else.
People tend to try and turn to any different type of medication that will assist in this type of thing. You know, obviously I hear people take, what is that? It's an antihistamine.
They will usually, I won't name the brand, but it's a chemical that's sometimes used for allergies. And it yes. is the drowsy version. Of,
right.
But, you know, we often think of, oh, make sure you get the non-drowsy one. Otherwise, it will knock you out during the day. Right. And what most people want then at night is the drowsy version, because it shuts down a chemical in your brain called histamine. And histamine is a wake promoting chemical. And when you have an antihistamine, which in the body is also associated with immune responses and allergic responses, but upstairs in the brain, it can control wakefulness and sleep, and therefore shut histamine down, you usually induce what looks like a sleep state. But then again, you develop dependency really quite quickly, and you develop a tolerance to those antihistamines quite quickly. And usually after about 10 to 15 days of continuous use, the benefit is no longer a benefit. So
I guess question on that front then, like when you think of these kind of sledgehammer tools that we have at our disposal, the scary stuff for me is when I was, you know, heard that some of these are linked to certain cancers and things like that. That is, do you still believe that to be the case, that some of these sleeping pills could be potential concern for certain types of cancers?
Yeah, there's certainly been some evidence of increased risk, associational risk for numerous different forms of cancer. And there's also been some evidence that those sleeping pills can leave you in a more immune deficient state, which in part may explain a greater vulnerability to things such as cancer. Do we have the causal evidence yet? No, we don't. So we can't say for sure. These could be associations. And I can bend that logic in the opposite way too. You know, I could say, we know that insufficient sleep is associated with a higher risk of certain forms of cancer. And perhaps what was happening is that the people for whom sleep has been difficult for their entire life have not been getting the sufficient sleep that they need. And it's the lack of sleep that they've had throughout their life that has predisposed them to a higher risk of cancer. But it's also those same people, as a consequence of that insufficient sleep, who then look to sleeping pills. And therefore, sleeping pills seem to indirectly look as though they induce a higher risk of cancer. But in fact, it was the bad sleep that those people were having all along, which led them to using sleeping pills.
Understood.
That caused the associational risk. But it's equally possible that it's the other way around, that the sleeping pills could induce cancer. Why don't we have those trials in human beings? My suspicion is that it's because they're not ethical, because the weight of the evidence is perhaps a little too scary that it wouldn't be ethically correct to look at that and explore that for the risk.
Yeah, it's crazy. When you do think of these big sledgehammer type drugs, you know, I would say that if you talk to physicians, you'll get a different recommendation by everyone. I only consider these in my own cabinet when I'm thinking of international travel.
Yeah.
So I fly over someplace, I get super jet lagged. I'm like, I got to go down, and there's nothing that's going to put me down unless I take something. You know, there's a whole slew of different drugs. Some doctors will tell you to take anti-anxiety meds.
That's right.
So benzos, you know, Xanax, things like that. I had one doctor recently was telling me that there's one drug called Suvorexant. Are you familiar with that one?
Suvorexant, yeah.
So, yeah. And that's supposed to be some new class of drug that's exciting. Is there any weight to that? And then also, when are benzos bad for or okay for travel? Or what's your, if you had to do it, which one are you? I mean, you don't have to recommend a brand, but
right.
Are these all just equally bad?
None of them are great. And the classic sleeping pills actually typically are benzos. The older sleeping medications, the older sedative hypnotics were strong benzos. The more recent sleep medications, and I won't name them, but lots of people would know them as sleeping pills, they still go after the same blunting, sedating receptor system in the brain called the GABA system, which stands for gamma-aminobutyric acid. It's basically the red light signal within the brain. It shuts down brain cell firing. And those classic sleeping pills, as well as the new, more modern sleeping pills, will all target that receptor system. The newer ones will simply tickle that receptor in a slightly different way with somewhat less side effects. But essentially, they're still doing that sedative blunting of the cortex and knocking it out. There are some anti-anxiety and antidepressant medications that have been typically prescribed off-label for sleep problems. Probably the most popular of those is trazodone. Trazodone does not go after the GABA receptor. It doesn't work like the classic benzos. So in that sense, it may be interesting to explore.
Because it's not as addictive, essentially. Benzos, there's tolerance issues and addiction issues, right?
And you can get pretty bad hangover effects from them as well. Trazodone is interesting. I've spent a lot of time reading a lot of the literature on trazodone. And again, I'm not a doctor, so I can't tell you anything about whether you should get it prescribed or not. But it does seem to have some potential benefit in terms of increasing the amount of deep sleep, decreasing the amount of time that it takes to fall asleep, and decreasing the amount of time that you are awake throughout the night. But normally when we see an increase in one form of sleep, such as deep sleep, it often can come at the cost of another type of sleep, such as REM sleep. They're not 100% mutually reciprocal, but they can have a push-pull association. But trazodone is interesting. From what I've read, it may increase deep sleep, but not come at the cost of compromising your REM sleep, which would be a favorable drug profile. Do we need much more data on trazodone? I think so. It's now, far past its time of being a non-generic drug, meaning it's generic, meaning it's, quite inexpensive as a treatment.
But that also means no pharmaceuticals want to spend any money to do the trials.
Well, and that's the downside. So, and with CBD, we're going to have to see who wants to put up the money. I know that there is a lot, and you would know this better than me, a lot of money out there in the private sector wanting to explore CBD. And that's why I'm going to do it.
Real quick there, on the trial front, what do you need to properly power a trial, both in terms of headcount on the consumer side and then also budget? What I'm just curious, could $250,000, $500,000, what is required to get some significant data?
It's usually in the several million dollar range.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But if you want to do
a Kickstarter, man.
Right, exactly, appropriately. And the reason is, it's all over the map in terms of the pricing, because what is the thing that you're trying to measure? What is the end outcome? Is it that you're focusing on the efficiency of sleep or the amount of deep sleep? Are you focusing on people who already have sleep difficulties, such as those with insomnia? Or are you focusing on people who are healthy sleepers? And are you expecting to get even better results despite them being healthy sleepers? All of these things will change what you expect to be the effect size of the drug, the impact effect size. And it's based on the effect size that we then can calculate and try to understand how many participants do we need? How many nights do we need to be recording them? In other words, how long should they be on this drug? All of those things create this multidimensional equation that ultimately dictates the bottom line dollar or pound or pick your currency value of that specific clinical trial.
Let me paint a picture for you that may be just a crazy one and stupid, and you can tell me if that's the case. How nutso would it be to have a tab on the Aura app where I can say, check the boxes, I understand, I'm giving my data away, this is at my own risk, blah, blah, blah. And then say, swipe CBD in input data. I took 35 milligrams tonight. Did you drink any drinks? No. Did you have caffeine today? No. Like a little cute, questionnaire. I hit submit. And now you receive that data back at the lab along with my baseline over the last couple of years. Is that useful, or is it just not high fidelity enough of data to, let's say you had several hundred thousand people doing that, which you could do when you have a device like Aura. Could studies ever be powered that way?
Hugely useful. I think it's one of the ways that we have not yet harnessed the ability of this self-quantified movement out there. And sleep is a great example of this. In truth, Aura already has something quite similar to this, where you can insert tags to your data and you can pick a tag and you can label that tag. Currently, those tags are often provided by the vendor, such as Aura. And so I think we can open up the aperture of that and we can give people additional tags such as CBD, THC, CBN, and we can then have you insert the dose.
This needs to happen because they did this with the COVID, right?
That's
correct. Aura had a trial with COVID.
They did an amazing job, you know, and I was not arriving at the company at the time when they were setting that up. And the data that they have now on COVID detection is quite spectacular. It is by far industry leading. And I think a lot of the other companies are desperately trying to catch up, in part because of their smarts with doing temperature assessment from the ring.
Yeah, it's interesting you should say that. My wife took part in that study with the Aura ring and she was doing it all and everything. And, you know, they send you these kits so you get tested, you actually run a COVID test and all this stuff. And she, we went out one night and because we were like celebrating, we had our vaccine shots, you know, we'd all like, we finally got to the point where we could actually go out and do something. And they poured us these massive like martinis at this place we went to. And, you know, we did all the bad things and woke up the next morning and like Aura was like, hey, we think you might have COVID. And she's like, no. Like my temperature is just like, you know, 3 points higher than it normally is because of all that alcohol. They made her take a test and she sent it in and it came back negative. But it was like, I mean, that just shows you alcohol is not good. I mean, it just obliterated our data.
Yeah, it can muddy the signal. And I actually had the signal. I received my first of the two shots. And I think probably about 2 weeks later, I saw a very observable deviation in my temperature, which I'll come back to regarding your question on, shouldn't we be doing this with CBD? And that got me pretty worried. And so I decided to self-quarantine. I canceled any work that I was doing with other people, certainly going into the sleep center because we have patients, many of them are in their older ages. We do a lot of work in Alzheimer's disease, immune compromised, et cetera. And it turns out that I actually had a different form of an infection when I finally got to my doctor. But that's how incredibly sensitive the device was with an infection detection system. But to come back to your point, I love this idea and it has to happen. Now, you could say, well, Matt, you've already told us that the accuracy of these devices is not especially high. It's not as good as you have in the sleep laboratory. And it's not. It's getting much closer. And I'm working with a company now and we're doing actually a lot of internal validation studies. And we just released a paper, Aura did, demonstrating, I think, the industry highest levels of accuracy, sensitivity, and specificity of any other device. And it will only get better. But the reason I still think your point is an elegant one is even if it is inaccurate to a degree, it is consistently inaccurate from one night to the night.
That's all that matters.
So in other words, its absolute accuracy isn't great, but its relative accuracy is very good. And so in other words, let's say that you have a spell where you're not taking CBD, and then you say, I'm going to do the experiment for a month where I start dosing with CBD. Any deviation from your past month of a baseline is going to be a real deviation. So what that absolute number change is may not necessarily be ultimately accurate, but the relative change from where you were at baseline versus when you were on drug, and then do the negative experiment where you come back off it and see if there's a relative decrease in your sleep quality. That to me is immensely powerful. So yes, I think we can in some ways crowdsource the same experiment to a degree using these sleep trackers. But really, in truth, what you want is the good, you know, if we're going to do this, I think that's a great way for us to get preliminary data that is supportive of the hypothesis to then justify doing something, let's say at my sleep center, which is more costly, but it is very granular. I will be looking at individual brain waves themselves and how they travel back across your cortex. What is the amplitude of those brain waves? How frequent are those brain waves coming? How coordinated are they with all of the other types of brain waves, which we know are critical? These are things that you can't get from sleep trackers right now. And those are the things that we also know can inflect, like an Archimedes lever, a change in certain health outcomes. That's why you would want to know that additional information above and beyond a simple sleep tracker when it comes to CBD.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited. I hope I'll talk to Harpreet as well and nudge him. I hope we can get a dedicated section of the app to do this type of research, because it can't just be some passive tagging system that, you know, it needs to be really well thought out from a usability and functionality standpoint to make sure you're gathering all the type of data consistently and right. in a way that you can make use of, you know.
And I will say that that is definitely on the radar map.
Oh, that's great.
At Aura, I think there's going to be some remarkable things. Obviously, I can't mention them. Well, I probably could, but I'd probably get shot at dawn by releasing trade secrets, as it were. But I can tell you that there's going to be a lot of remarkable progress with the company, probably within the next year, that I think will make it, if it's not already, certainly the industry leader. But by the way, I should come back to CBD. The other mechanism that got me interested in, the reason I would want to do some of these studies in the laboratory, is firstly, not because of my predilection for inserting rectal probes, which is neither fun for the experimenter nor the participant.
That has to happen?
Well, the reason I would want it to happen in some of these studies is because we've spoken about before on the last podcast that we did about the importance of temperature for sleep.
Yes.
That you need to drop your brain's core temperature and your body's core temperature by about one right. degree Celsius, or about 2 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit, to fall asleep and stay asleep. And that's the reason that, you know, falling asleep in a room that's too cold is usually easier than a room that's too hot. One of the interesting profiles that we've started to see in animal studies where they've been dosed with CBD is that they get cold. In other words, CBD seems to be an inducer of what we call a hypothermic response. And I think one of the other non-mutually exclusive pathways through which CBD produces, if it does, a benefit to sleep, is not just because it's an anxiolytic, which is, I think, an indirect mechanism. It's taking away the anxiety and therefore removing a roadblock to sleep that is already there for the taking, if only you could get rid of the anxiety. Instead, this is a very different mentality, which is, here is a proactive benefit of CBD. It's not removing something that's a blockade. It's adding something that is a potentiator of sleep, which is a drop in your core body temperature. And that's why I would want to do some of those studies. Could we actually look at, now we could look at some of that with the Aura Ring, although that's a peripheral temperature measure. I would want to be looking at your core body temperature. And that's why I would have the delightfully interesting job of using the rectal probes.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like the best part of your day.
I mean, if either you as the experimenter or the participant have any shred of dignity before that procedure happens, trust me, you are stripped of it very soon afterwards.
Well, the good news is you're running the lab now, so presumably you have some postdoc or something, or somebody else doing this.
Thankfully, I am usually now out of the equation, but let's just say that experimenter and participant become very familiar with each other very quickly under those circumstances.
Speaking of body temperature, you know, one of the things that I do a lot of reading up on heat shock proteins, and you know, this idea of using the sauna, which I use for doing that side of things. And I have to stick myself in the sauna at 173 degrees for 20 minutes, and it raises your core body temperature. And they've done experiments where, you know, same idea, they check the probe and make sure that it actually is raising core body temperature, but it's pretty extreme heat. Your body's pretty good, it seems to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, obviously I'm no scientist, at regulating body temperature. So you have to kind of get pretty hardcore to move it by a couple degrees, meaning like I have to sit in a hot sauna and sweat it out just to make it move a bit. But that's great, and it gets the benefit that I want on the longevity side of the house, and all the science behind the heat shock proteins. I'm curious on dropping body temperature. you know, there's sleep aids, there's a handful of different devices that you strap onto your bed, and it puts water through the top surface of your mattress and can actually chill you. For me, it's kind of just pissing me off, because I like to sleep a little warmer. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, you know, when that kicks in like an hour and a half after I've been sleeping, I'm like, oh, there's the cold coming in, you know. Right. Is it just pissing me off, or is it really doing anything? Like, is it really reducing and dropping my core body temperature to where it would have a positive effect on my sleep?
I think what you would want to do is have a look at the data and do the formal experiment. And temperature is an interesting thing. It's highly variable from one person to the next. Obviously, men on average typically run hotter than women at night. I would say that you do have to be a little bit careful, because what you're trying to do is cool the core of the body. And as you're falling asleep, the way strangely that the body typically drops your core temperature is to warm up the outer surfaces, particularly the hands and the feet. And by warming those up, and they did these great studies in rats to discover this. They would lift these rats up and they would gently warm the surface of the pores of the rats, which would essentially charm all of the blood to the surface of those pores. And when it was there, it would radiate out the temperature from the core of the body, and the core body temperature would plummet. So in other words, you have to warm up to cool down to get to sleep. And then once there, you have to stay cool to stay asleep. Now, if you get too cold, however, it can have an adverse effect.
That's what happens with me. I wake up because I'm too cold.
Right. And so you may want to play around with the thermal signature of that programmed temperature mattress, or however you dial it in, to make sure that you're not compromising sleep. And one of the downsides with the en masse approach, and although I haven't used the sleep aid, the topper yet, but one may want to be a little bit thoughtful of trying to do local warming and cooling rather than global warming and cooling, meaning that you may want to try to warm certain parts of the body as best you can whilst cooling other parts of the body, meaning the core of the body versus the periphery of the body. That's, I think...
Interesting. So, okay. So what you're saying is, in some sense, I could go and have a cooler mattress topper that's digitally programmed to cool me down, but wear pajama bottoms, like wear the heavier garments on the legs and extremities, but let it cool the core. Is that right?
I think we're close enough friends now for me to start to deliberate your fashion outcome at night, Kevin. So I will, if that's the flag that you want to raise, which is putting warm socks on at night, I will probably salute it 5 ways till Tuesday, because it could help. I am also of the, this probably tells you about my age, which I'm solidly now in the foothills of middle age. I will sometimes take a hot water bottle to bed. I'll put it at the end of the bed, you know, 5 minutes before I get in there. And then I'll try and warm my feet to get the heat going through my feet. What's interesting, though, is the science is really good on this point. You may have noticed it's very difficult. If you have cold hands and cold feet, it's very difficult to fall asleep. And the reason is because by way of those hands and feet being so cold, the blood gets locked into the core of your body. And so you can't expel the heat. You can't evacuate the heat out of the body. So trying to do local warming of these highly vascular areas called the feet and the hands. And of course, most of us will stick our head outside of the covers too, because our head is a place where we lose, or we can lose and radiate out a lot of heat. It's very difficult to have a head that's ensconced and too hot, so that you just can't release the heat from it. So I think we are in gen one of temperature manipulation using gadgets and the mattress. I do like the mattress, though, as a vehicle for sleep manipulation. And I should offer my disclaimers too. I'm an advisor to a company called Bryte, which is Bryte, which is also a smart mattress that uses AI technology with temperature augmentation and pressure augmentation. I think we're in Gen 1 there, but the reason I enjoy that as a concept is because if you were to think of your car that you own right now versus a car of 50 years ago, they are radically different. Your car in this day and age, it is packed full of all sorts of sensors and gadgetry. But if you were to think about a mattress from 50 years ago and your mattress now, the standard mattress that most people have, they are much more similar than they are different. Why is that the case? Why don't we have, you know, a Gen 4, Gen 5 version of a mattress in this day and age? It's still so rudimentary, but its potential as an augmenting tool for modifying and optimizing human sleep, I think, is currently untapped. And that's why I like the form factor of the mattress as a way to potentially architect better sleep at night.
Yeah, it's very cool. And I agree, it is early days for this stuff. Worst case scenario, I mean, I do like that I can just get into a toasty bed and then just tell it to turn itself off. You know, it's kind of like, especially during the winter months. But Daria, my wife, would kill me if I didn't ask you this, because she's been having what she considers to be great success with chamomile extract and using that as a way to kind of help with her sleep issues. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there. I think we all avoid melatonin now these days. There's a valerian root. I've done 3 grams of glycine mixed with magnesium. I've had some, you know, subjective great success with that combination. What do you think of chamomile, and how about these other, you know, there's probably 10 or so supplements that people tend to turn to for sleep. One other thing I should mention is a lot of people are doing L-theanine with a GABA combo.
Right.
Thoughts on all of that?
So right now, the evidence for chamomile isn't particularly strong relative to placebo in randomized controlled studies, which in some ways probably just tells you more about the strength of the placebo effect than it necessarily does about the lack of any sleep assistance that chamomile provides.
How about the extract that they're isolating one particular component inside of chamomile now and doing it as a very concentrated extract? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No randomized studies yet, but I know the component that you're talking about.
Yeah.
I think I know of one group in Europe that is starting to try and do a pretty good randomized placebo control trial on that component. But right now, I don't think the evidence is that supportive of chamomile. And please tell Daria, I'm desperately sorry for saying that. But I would, she's a brilliant scientist herself, and she would, I think, probably agree with me. As scientists, however, we always have to keep in mind that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
And right.
Just because we don't have any data sufficient yet to say that it has a benefit doesn't necessarily discount it as having the potential for a benefit at some point should we do the appropriate studies. So I'll just put that out there.
Yeah, it's apigenin, I think is what it's
That's
called,
correct.
The extract.
That's yeah. right, yep. And so in terms of GABA, right now from my reading of the literature, there have been really 3 fairly decent randomized placebo-controlled trials. And when I say randomized placebo-controlled trials, I won't bore you with what they are. Essentially, they are the kind of one of the gold standards for clinical pharmacological science and medicine. 2 of the 3 studies with GABA showed no benefit whatsoever, and they were null findings. 1 of the 3 studies did demonstrate some benefit. I think they found a significant increase in total amount of sleep, and they also found a reduction in the speed with which it took you to fall asleep, which is what we call the sleep onset latency, which is a terrible term. Just means how quickly did you fall asleep?
I've heard GABA is really hard. It's not very bioavailable.
Correct.
Is that true? And so could it be that it's not in the, because I heard if you take it in the liposomal form, like with a fat, it helps. Do you know anything about that?
It's possible that it can help with the blood-brain barrier transition. And in fact, that brings us quite nicely onto magnesium. The evidence there is really quite robust that suggests magnesium doesn't have any benefit in healthy people or in people with insomnia. There are, I think, at least on the market right now, there are at least 9 different forms of magnesium that you can take. And yes, I'll come back to why I think that's important in a second. You can ask, well, so many people say magnesium for sleep, it's helpful. Where does that come from? And I really took a historical lens analysis of this in the literature. It seems to be, best I can tell, emerged from early studies where they found that people who were deficient in magnesium also didn't have particularly good sleep. But that's a very different scenario than saying in someone who is already magnesium sufficient, not deficient, right, and who already has good sleep. That doesn't mean that supplementing with magnesium, if you are a healthy individual who is magnesium sufficient, it doesn't mean that it's going to improve your sleep. It just means that if you are magnesium deficient and you have bad sleep, it could help, even though we haven't seen it being beneficial for those with insomnia. There is only one subset of a cohort where we have seen magnesium to be a benefit, which is in older adults with insomnia. And that's probably because older adults are often typically deficient in magnesium. The reason that I brought up the different flavors of magnesium is because most of them will not cross the blood-brain barrier. But magnesium threonate has, which came out of a group from MIT. They published a paper in a high impact journal, some years ago now, in animal studies where they had developed this form of magnesium that does seem to be better able to get into the brain and pass through this thing called the blood-brain barrier, which is essentially like the red rope at the fancy, you know, nightclub. And do you get VIP access or not? That's the blood-brain barrier. It keeps most things out except for VIP guests. And they had developed a sort of a VIP form of magnesium that they thought could cross the blood-brain barrier, and it did seem to. And that is now out there. I think one of the companies out there right now is Magteen.
Yes.
And so,
have they proven that in humans as well?
Like, no, not that I'm aware of.
That's what I. That was my only hesitation there, is I didn't see that it.
And it's hard to do that because it would probably require invasive technology or a special type of a PET scan where you have something called a ligand, which goes into the brain and binds onto certain receptors.
Like a stain kind of thing?
Exactly. So it's essentially acting like a stain in the brain that goes away, don't worry. It's just a temporary stain, but can tell you, has the magnesium entered or not? And we really just don't have that technology yet. So, jury is out on whether or not MAG-T will be the ultimate weapon in the arsenal of magnesium sleep supplementation. Valerian, which you mentioned, also unfortunately goes the same way as magnesium. There have now been a huge amount of studies looking at valerian, and I think at least 7 very good, in my mind, placebo-controlled randomized trials. 5 of the 7 showed no benefit whatsoever relative to placebo. 2 of the 7 had too little data to really say anything. The most recent study came out, looked at 2 different doses of valerian, 300 milligrams and 600 milligrams. And I'm blanking on how long they did this duration of dosing. But what was stunning was, firstly, it also had no effect. But in that study, they measured just about every sleep variable that you could imagine in the needle in a haystack search for a positive effect, and they couldn't find anything. And in fact, they ended up performing well over 25 different statistical tests, and there was no benefit to be found.
Wow.
And that's noteworthy because when you perform that many statistical tests simply by chance alone, you would likely have produced at least one spurious significant result. But despite the deck stacked in its statistical favor, valerian root couldn't muster an effect. So,
well, what's crazy about valerian is it's actually one of those ones that you can feel. Like, it's not just like, you know, you take magnesium and I don't necessarily feel anything, glycine same way. Like, it's, but valerian is always, it has been used in the past outside of sleep to treat anxiety. Isn't
that's
that
right.
The case?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there, you know, I think the evidence is probably stronger for it as an anxiolytic.
What about glycine?
Glycine is interesting. And I think so far there are 4 different studies on glycine. And for the most part, it does seem to produce fairly robust sleep effects. Now, those sleep effects, we haven't gone into detail. We don't know about the individual different stages of sleep necessarily. but glycine does seem to improve the overall efficiency of sleep based on the scientific studies, meaning you spend more of the time that you're in bed asleep versus awake. And it may also help with the total amount of sleep, as well as a reduction in the amount of time that you spend awake at night. So I think I'm probably a little bit more bullish on glycine. Normally glycine,
it's just an amino acid, right?
Correct. Yeah. And it's usually of a higher dose.
So you can get that
dose.
In bone broth if you just wanted to, because it's pretty high in bone broth, I believe.
Yeah. I don't know what the levels are. And typically for some of the sleep benefits, you're seeing a dose of above 1 gram. So many of the supplements that we speak about will be in the milligram range. I spoke about valerian there at 300 and 600 milligrams. Glycine typically requires a higher dose.
Yeah. I think it was 2 or 3 grams. Yeah. The studies
exactly.
I saw it.
Yeah. I think the current recommend, I don't know actually if there is a standard recommended amount by medicine, but I think typically what is assumed in medicine is somewhere around 2 to 3 grams of glycine requirement for the average adult. So supplementing with a gram is, you know, it could be within biophysical realms, which is important. You don't want to be taking what's called a supra physiological dose. In other words, a dose that is far in excess of anything that your body would naturally assume to be familiar with. That can have deleterious effects and feedback effects where it can shut down your body's own production of certain chemicals. And we worry about that with melatonin, because most people are taking a supra physiological dose of maybe 5 milligrams or 10 milligrams, when in fact the optimal dose, if you look at the studies, for any small benefit, which typically happens in older adults and those with insomnia, is in the realm of 0.3 milligrams.
Right.
So most people are taking somewhere between 5 to 20 times the amount of melatonin that the body would normally be naturally used to. And therefore, the worry is that your body thinks, well, if I'm getting this much, I don't need to produce my own, and it stops producing it. And a good medical example of that is consistent testosterone supplementation in males, which will ultimately mean that that male ends up ceasing to produce any of their own testosterone after a while.
Right.
So I think in terms of other supplements that have interested me of late, Kurt Parsley, who is a great sleep physician, a sleep doctor, just a remarkable human being too. He's got his own sleep supplement out there, and I'm not part of that company. I'm not trying to sort of endorse it, but he got me interested in a compound that he's got in his sleep formulation called phosphatidylserine.
Yes. You know, Peter Attia actually prescribes this, or not prescribes it, but recommends it as a supplement. He has in the past, at least.
That's right. A couple years ago. Peter and I have spoken about it several times, and it's a naturally occurring lipid inside of your body, and it serves a bunch of different important roles. But supplementing with phosphatidylserine in some circumstances does seem to have an indirect benefit on sleep. And the reason it's indirect is that it seems to have a profile where it can lower the amount of cortisol. Now, we all need cortisol. It's a critical hormone. And it typically drops, however, in the late evening hours, and it falls to its lowest point, what we call the cortisol nadir, right before you go to sleep and in the first hour or two once you are into sleep. And if you look at people who have insomnia, we typically see that cortisol starts to come down during the evening. And then just before they start to go to bed, their cortisol levels rise. And so cortisol can be an inhibiting factor against this thing called a solid night of sleep.
Is that due to the fear of not sleeping?
Well, that's what it seems to be, could be both a reaction and a cause, both a consequence and a trigger. But what we know is that in those people who have what we call sleep onset insomnia, they will have this spike in cortisol when they should be going to their lowest point. And then in people who have what we call sleep maintenance insomnia, which is a different form of insomnia, although you can have both. So sleep onset insomnia, I can't fall asleep. Sleep maintenance insomnia, I can't stay asleep. And in those category of insomniac patients, we also see a middle of the night spike in cortisol relative to healthy sleepers. And there it would be a non-conscious potential response. But phosphatidylserine, either at 200 milligrams, seems to be reliable and unreliable at lowering cortisol, 400 milligrams has been shown to be more effective at reducing cortisol, although under specific circumstances, which is exercise-related cortisol increases. That's where they've tried to induce cortisol and then block it with phosphatidylserine. 400 milligrams seems to do that. But then there have been some studies where they've used 400 milligrams for several weeks or 750 milligrams, I think it was, for 10 days. And that didn't really produce that much of a reliable cortisol drop. And I started to then think, well, maybe this phosphatidylserine isn't a great thing. But then I read a further study that got me more excited. If you are trying to, let's say that I've got a new device that increases your blood oxygen saturation, but you're already at 99.5% oxygen saturation, and I give you more oxygen, it's not really going to change anything because you're already at saturated levels, because you're at ceiling. Well, the issue here with phosphatidylserine looks like it could be a floor versus a ceiling issue, meaning that if you look at the effects of phosphatidylserine in those people who don't have a high level of stress and a high level of cortisol, you don't see much of a benefit. But in those people who have high levels of stress and high levels of cortisol, that's where phosphatidylserine seems to have a benefit. And no wonder, you know, if it's already low, how can a supplement make it any lower? And that's what got me once again excited about that too. So that's another supplement, I think, together with another one called ashwagandha, which you can buy, that seems to also reduce levels of cortisol. It may also increase the inhibitory transmitter in the brain called GABA that we spoke about before. So I think there's a bunch of different supplements that are starting to emerge. And I'm going to go, I'll probably do a very detailed post-mortem on all of these different supplements in a whole series during the podcast.
I was hoping you were going to say that. That's awesome.
Yeah, just go into each one and really let's get a lens on this. Let's get a bead on this. What is fact? What is fiction? And what can we say about it at the end of the day?
Fantastic. Well, Matt, I think that's a great place to end. I don't want to take up too much of your time. It's a pleasure to have you back on the show. And I'm really pumped for your podcast because I have all these questions that come up during the year because you always hear about every few months, somebody's got something they're trying to tell you about is fixed sleep. Like that's
right.
insert new supplement, right?
Yeah.
And it'll be nice to have these updates from you and deep dives into the literature and to separate the fact from fiction. So I'm very, very excited.
Oh, thank you.
People can subscribe right now. And I started listening to your first episode already, which is great, kind of like ground setting and laying out all the details of what is sleep. And so this isn't something you have to wait for. If you're listening, you can go subscribe to the show and start getting episodes.
Yep. It's out there. And we just released the second episode. So folks can just search for my name and podcast and they'll get there. And probably the best place, I'm on Twitter at Sleep Diplomat, but I finally moved into the 21st century and I got onto Instagram. So on Instagram, I am Dr. Matt Walker, all one word. So DrMattWalker. And that's the place where I'll probably try to interact with the community or have been interacting with the community. And so what I would love for the podcast, I've got probably about already 40 different episodes that I already know that I want to be recording, but I want to hear from the audience because I know what I know and I hope that it's somewhat useful for most people. But what's going to be great is for people to start to tell me, firstly, how I can be doing this better, because as most people can hear from this recording, I'm not particularly good at this thing, but tell me how I can get better. But the more important thing is tell me what it is that you want to learn about sleep. Do you want to learn about that particular new supplement that you heard about from a friend last week? Or, you know, is this form of cardio exercise at this time of day more beneficial than that form of cardio at that time of day?
Right.
You know, how do I figure out if I'm a night owl or a morning type? And does that really matter? And ask me all of these questions. Tell me what you want to hear. And what's hopefully great is that because the podcasts are usually around 10 minutes or less, I can take any one of those head on and I will do a deep dive into anything that the audience wants. It's the audience's show.
That's fantastic. I love that. It's a great way to kind of bottoms up approach to finding the best content and presenting it. I'll throw one that we didn't get a chance to cover in the ring right now, which is, you know, there's two new books I have recently read, one called Breathe and the other one called Jaws, talking about, you know, how you, the importance of, some people are duct taping their mouths shut to hopefully sleep better through the night, through their nose. We both have to run. I do too, but what's your 30-second version of those books?
So, I've only read Breathe, fantastic book. I've got to know James Nestor, the author. He's just across the bay from me here in San Francisco. Incredible human being, brilliant book. Mouth taping, I've started to play around with it. I've been doing that before I read the book for about 2 years. There is some evidence that it can be beneficial, but there are caveats. Speak to your doctor about it. But I think it actually has some mileage to it.
Yes. It was really great book, fun read. I got it on Audible and, do not do it to your kids.
No.
That is like a big no-no. I just wanted to say that, and definitely read the book and talk to your doctor for more info there. But, Matt, a pleasure as always, and congratulations on the new show.
Oh, thank you.
And, let's do this again, hopefully in person at some point.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much for having me on. It's just always a privilege and a delight to just mind meld with you and think deeply about sleep. So thanks again. And congratulations to you on, I know your podcast is not new anymore, but I have adored it, even though I'm not in sort of the crypto space. I'm a nerd and I love that stuff. And you are an elegant interviewer. You are a brilliant mind. And I gobble that stuff up. I wait for each episode. So congrats to you as well.
Well, that I can help you with. We'll do a little swap. I'll help you buy cryptocurrency and you help me sleep better at night, and done deal.
Fair exchange. I love it. Kevin, thank you again.
Awesome. Thank you. All right. That is it for this episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. Quick reminder, two other podcasts that I'm currently recording that you should give a listen to. One, all about cryptocurrency, all the different coins, everything happening in DeFi. You can find that one at modern.finance. The other, all about the crazy NFT ecosystem. That is everything happening in art on the blockchain, generative art. We interview artists and builders. It's a really fun show. That one's called Proof, and you can find it at proof.xyz. Thanks for listening, and take care.